תגור אינונה ברשותת אדור קושו ניגין יחדית אינונה ישבית קימנה פת ביאר פוצי גרים מקונק נניה Inuim Nayarimi.
Hello and welcome to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford, sitting in Annapolis, Maryland on my cat rig schooner, Alt. For those of you who don't know, Alt seems like a strange name for a boat, and a lot of people get it confused with the key on your keyboard, although I assure you it has nothing to do with a keyboard. I grew up hearing stories from my grandfather about the Alt. The Alt was the USS Alt. It was the destroyer that he served on in World War II. And so I grew up, Matty, my boy, let me tell you about the Battle of the Coral Sea, or the kamikazes were coming out of the sky, you know. So I grew up hearing all these stories about the USS Alt when my grandfather was in the Pacific. And he worked in two places on the ship. He worked in the gunpowder room, which is just going to blow up. I guess it's a quick death. And then he worked at the steam engine. And I guess the steam engine was like 150 degrees. It was like insanely hot. And you're stuck in this deep part of the boat. And if the steam engine goes, you could die from steam, which was a whole lot worse than getting blown up from gunpowder. So that's where my grandpa had probably the two places on a boat that nobody wanted to be. But that's where I got, to pay respects to him. And he was a great man. Go on about him, I guess, on a later date and time. But I named my boat after him to show respect. So I always give a little blurb at the end of this thing. I'm going to do it at the beginning because I always run out of time at the end. I get so caught up telling sailing stories. So for absolutely free, you can hire me as your buyer's agent. And so when you're looking to buy a boat, you want to, there's a whole ocean of used boats on the market out there. Some of them are absolute gems, and some of them are absolute lemons. And so you shoot me an email at matt@davidwaltersyachts.com, and you tell me a bunch of parameters. I send you some information. Tell me what you're looking for. I search the web. We go view a bunch of different boats. And over time, we narrow it down, and we find you the best boat for what you want to do with the amount of money you have, and et cetera, et cetera. And it doesn't cost you a penny. It is absolutely free. I get paid out of the commission on the back end, so it doesn't cost you anything. I want to talk about a boat every podcast, and I want to talk about Pacific Seacraft 37s. I think that I've sailed quite a few Pacific Seacrafts. I've always been a fan of the Cree Lock design. I've always been a fan of double enders. Now, a naysayer will tell you that a double ender doesn't have the same amount of buoyancy in the stern, and in some way that makes it, I don't know, bad, like unsea kindly, or I guess people are actually implying that it makes it dangerous, which is a ridiculous thing, because double enders are, it's a really good design for dealing with heavy weather. Now, you got to remember that even the Vikings had double enders, and the Vikings had some of the best boats of their time, and those things were double enders, more or less. I mean, totally different design, but they were pointy in the back and they were pointy in the front. And, the idea is that when you got to run down large waves, let's say you got 30-foot waves, all right? Let's say you got 60 knots sustained, you're in the middle of the North Atlantic, and it's been blowing that way for 24 hours, and it's going to keep blowing that way for another 24 hours. So you got a fully matured sea, you got unlimited fetch. Anything over 600 miles of fetch is just considered unlimited. So you got unlimited fetch, so you're going to have the biggest sea you can get. So let's just say in that condition, you probably have 30-foot waves. So you got 30-foot waves. What are you going to do? You could heave two. That's one option. Some boats heave two a lot better than others. I could tell you a Pacific Sea Craft is going to heave two very, very well. But a Bavaria is going to isn't going to heave two at all. I mean, trying to heave two on a Bavaria is, you got a better chance of squeezing blood from a stone, you know. But when you got these big seas, you're going downwind. It doesn't matter anymore which direction you go, because whatever direction you were going is irrelevant. You're in the middle of the ocean. You're in the middle of a storm. You got 30-foot seas. You're not considering, I'm not sailing towards my waypoint and my velocity made good is getting all screwed up. You're just going the way that you have. And the pointy end on a double ender will help to break big following seas. And, you won't get this happening every time, but every once in a while you'll get a wave that breaks especially hard on the crest of one of these large waves. And when that happens, if you have a big, square, flat stern, the wave, as it's breaking and boiling and rolling over itself in this big, white, foamy wall that's about to hit the back of your boat, when that's happening, and this has happened on my Pearson 323, because I was in a bunch of gales and storms, but one proper one that did have some waves approaching 30 feet, it'll grab the back of your stern and push you forward. This has happened on the Alban Vega every once in a while too, actually. It's hard to avoid, especially on smaller boats with big stern, big flat traditional sterns. The wave, as it breaks, just slams into it, and it pushes you forward with the breaking wave, and it makes it more likely that you're going to broach hard to either port or starboard. And if you broach hard, you can rip your rudder off, you can leave yourself beam on to the next big wave that could come crashing down right on your side and roll you. So, a double ender, it does break that up a bit, and it was only 2 months ago, maybe 2.5 months ago, that I was bringing up that Valiant 42 and got that 45 to 60 blow. And it was coming up behind us. I talked about it in an earlier podcast. And that boat did great. So anyways, there's the long explanation of why I think a double ender is awesome. Also, double enders are built to sort of traditional specs. You know, they're not too modern. And traditional specs of an era from, the 60s and 70s. It was from that time period. But a lot of the lines, I think, go back a lot further than that. But boats traditionally weren't built to be floating condos or weren't built for the cocktail party like a lot of these plastic fantastic boats are being built for today. You know, they were built for going into the ocean and for dealing with what you're going to deal with in the ocean, which can be anything from being flat calm and bobbing around like a cork to being hit by 30-foot waves, or maybe worse. You can survive 30-foot waves. You know, you can. You can make it through it. Hell, you can make it through without a scratch. Part of it is going to have to do with luck, because you know what? That you could also get killed by that same situation. So it depends, good luck, bad luck. Part of it depends on your boat, your experience, how prepared you are to deal with the situation. I mean, there's a lot of elements that go into it. But I think, double-ended sailboats, they're just traditional, man, from the bottom, from the keel to the masthead, you know. And I think that we've lost the sailboat market. Sailboats have lost some of their sea kindly abilities or sea going abilities with a lot of these modern designs, because they're just designing the boats for different purposes. They're designing them to be as spacious as possible and be somewhat cavernous. But anyways, the Pacific Sea Craft 37, the reason I like this boat is it's an ideal boat for a single-hander, and it's an ideal boat for a cruising couple. If you got like a bunch of kids, or if you're going to have people sail with you a lot, it's probably not the best. It's like a cruising couple that has occasional visitors, because there's places for them to sleep. But it's really, it's not a huge, but no double ender is going to be giant inside. Because it's pointy on the back, you lose space inside the boat. I mean, they're not built for that purpose. So it's not, you know, it is what it is. But a double ender is never going to have the same kind of space inside. But the there are smaller Pacific Sea crafts, you know, like a 34. And those are great boats, but they feel small inside. The 37 was like the first Pacific Sea craft that really had enough space inside of it where it feels livable. And they really push the interior of the boat all the way to the sides, which does eliminate some storage behind the settees, but it also increases just the feel, the living ability. I don't know. It's really well done in a lot of ways. And I delivered a Pacific Sea Craft 44 through the Panama Canal and up to San Diego about, I don't know, a year and a half ago, I guess. And, you know, the 44 wasn't bad. The larger Pacific Sea Crafts do need more wind. You know, the 37 will still operate well, will sail well in light winds. The larger boat, when we did have 30 knots at one point, and that was the only time I saw that boat really come to life. You know, the Pacific Sea Craft, the larger ones, really, it's like they want to be alive in the southern latitudes, you know, going around capes or something. Yeah, I don't know. You need a lot of wind to get them moving. Where the 37 is just a lot more responsive. And, you know, like I say, the 37 is really the boat I should have took around the Americas. Like, if I could take a fiberglass boat and pick one out of a hat, Pacific Sea Craft 37 would be high on my list as a really good single-handed boat or for a couple. And yeah, so if you have interest in Pacific Sea Craft 37s, let me know. I do have one here at a good price, about 25 grand less than what they usually are, because the guy's in his 80s and he just wants to sell it. But you know, I really like double enders. You know, what can I say? I like traditional sailboats. I think they're pretty. You know, so let me tell you a little bit about this delivery that I did on this Pacific Sea Craft, this 44, which is a little bit of a strange animal, really. It's more spacious than like a Valiant 42, if you wanted to try to compare it to another double ender of that size. But it was a little unwieldy, maybe. I don't know. I mean, it didn't quite perform as well as the 42, I guess, of the, you know, the Valiant 42. But anyway, so you go through the Panama Canal. For those of you who have not been through the Panama Canal, it's broken up over 2 days. You spend a night in the middle in this big lake. And that's basically, the canal is a bunch of locks. It goes to a big lake, and then it goes to a bunch of locks. And you're either in the Pacific or the Atlantic, depending on which way you started. And that's the passage. And so you spend a night on this massive, massive mooring. This mooring was literally so big, I jumped off the boat and stood on it, and I could have stood 10 more people on this mooring. I mean, it was absolutely massive mooring. And it's nice. It was nice. It was in the winter time, you know, like December, I think it was actually early January. I had a weird situation happen, probably the craziest part of this whole delivery. I was taking a bus, and I caught a bus to this town over by where the, there's not many marinas left on the Caribbean side of the Panama Canal. So I take this, it's all confusing. It's all hell. I go to a bus station. There's like 10 million people there. I can't get any English. I don't speak any Spanish. I end up meandering. Somehow I got on the right bus. I don't even know how I made it, because there's like buses everywhere. Like, I don't even know how I got on. But anyways, it's a double-decker bus, and I'm sitting upstairs and on the back. And I'm like finally feeling peace, because that whole bus station thing really stressed me out. So it's like an hour bus ride, hour and a half bus ride from like the capital to where we were going, and over by the entrance of the Panama Canal. I don't remember the name of the town. It starts with a C. I guess it's a pretty rough town. Tourists don't go there very much, but it's as close as I can get to where I need to get to this marina. So, you know, it's getting dark. It's dark out now. They had some little movie playing in Spanish, and I was sort of just zoning out. You know, you're sitting on a bus, looking out the window, zoning out, you know. And we stop at downtown in this region, and all of a sudden I hear all this screaming. Like, well, first off, we stopped a bunch of places. This was the final stop. And I'm walking out at this point. I got my bag over my shoulder. I got my other bag. I'm joining this delivery. And I was on the upstairs of a double-decker bus, and it has these stairs. And right in front of me, there is this really, really large lady. And just really, you know, like, I don't know, like 350, 400 pounds. And so anyways, we're going down the steps, and this dude rushes in the bus with a knife, like throwing, I don't know, I wouldn't have understood him. I don't even know if he was speaking Spanish. Like, it sounded like just crazy gibberish that he was screaming. And he was like robbing the bus. And he looks at me, and I got this bag, and he's trying to like get up. You know, I'm standing at the top of the steps. He's trying to get past this really big, heavy set, African-American lady. And he's trying to get past her and climb over, and he can't get past her. She's like taking up the whole stairway. And so he's screaming at me for a minute and trying to climb over her. And I'm looking at him just like giant eyeballs, like, what the hell is happening? The bus driver comes out of nowhere and tackles him like off the bus. And then all the people like just like scream, like I don't know, like everybody was so shocked when it first happened. Nobody said anything. All of a sudden people are screaming. This poor heavy set lady underneath me on the steps is like crying her eyes out. People are like literally like hiding their necklaces, ducking their chains, you know, putting their rings in their pockets. And we drive like 50 feet and the door opens up again and everybody has to get off. I'm like, geez, we're like right next to it. Like, is this guy still outside? Like this knife wielding maniac who tried to climb over this lady to try to get to me. Like, I don't know. It was really weird because it was one of those things where it went from zero to absolutely insane in like 2 seconds. You know, it was just like I was so chill and so mellow. I'd just been on this bus ride after this crazy bus station experience in Panama. I'm just trying to get to this Pacific Seacraft 44 so I can deliver it up to San Diego. And all this craziness happens. So anyways, I got to cut the commercial.
Bonnie Las Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Las is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland. And now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Las Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielascharters.com.
I'm John Herlig. In Postcards from Sea, I tell stories of my travels aboard Ave Del Mar, my 1967 Rawson cutter. I deal with serious nautical issues like how to sail your mast into a tree on a canal, what kind of incense best covers the aroma of kimchi fermenting on your boat, or whether or not I can beat a leukemia patient at a video game. It's simply the story of my life, and my life happens to take place on a 50-year-old sailboat with no particular destination in mind. I hope you'll join me and some of the wonderful characters I meet as I travel for my show, Postcards from Sea, every other Monday here on Boat Radio.
Time goes forward, go and catch your jet, you will find your moment. Time goes forward, stay and have a sniff, let's dream about the future.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I'm Matt Rutherford, sitting on my boat. So anyways, went through the Panama Canal. There's a few locks on the Pacific side that can be kind of nasty, but you know, for the most part it's not that bad. Interesting thing is when you're tightly packed in the lock and there's still some current in there and they open the lock and you're like getting sucked into the boat in front of you and trying not to like hit it and trying not to get hit by whatever's behind you. And that's the fun part. All the rest isn't that bad, really. I mean, all the rest, you got lines and line handlers, and that's a good time if you're a single-hander to have somebody come down if you're going through the Panama Canal, you got to have so many line handlers, and you got to have a pilot, and so you can hire them. But if you don't have the people, just have some of your friends come down and join you and do the Panama Canal with them, or find another boat that's doing the Panama Canal, and do a trade-off. You know, I'll come with you today, and you come with me, you know, in a few days from now when I go through. And people do that all the time also. But yeah, the delivery was, yeah, there wasn't much else to say about that delivery, really. There's a place off Mexico called Tehuantepec in southern Mexico. It's just north of Puerto Chiapas. You want to be real careful going around Tehuantepec. It can blow like 60 knots for 3-4 days straight out like 100 miles. It's like a blowtorch. It's really weird. It has something to do with the mountains there. It's like the air from the Gulf of Mexico funnels through these mountains, and it gets funneled in such a way that it comes out like a blowtorch, and it's just vicious. They have something there called a dog bark navigation. Dog bark navigation is when you navigate, you stay so close to the beach that you can hear the dogs barking. And the reason you're so close to the beach is because that's the direction the wind is coming out of. So the idea is, if you can stay right up on the beach, even if it's blowing like 30, 40, 50, 60 knots, if you're right next to the beach, there's not going to be much fetch. And if there's not much fetch, then you're not going to have that much wave action. Although it sounds horrible to me. First off, you got to worry about running aground, even though the waves are more or less in your favor. And second off, that'd be really short, choppy, I've seen nasty fetch in 60 knots of wind. I've seen nasty fetch when I've got land like less than a quarter mile away from me, and it can get nasty and choppy and whatnot. At least I've seen it like that in Greenland. It's got to be. So I went around it. I wasn't going to mess with that sort of stuff. I went out like 100 and some miles. I went out like 100 miles, and I went around basically the end of the blowtorch. And that was the only time that, like I said, that boat really seemed alive, was when we had blowing 30 and 35 knots. So speaking of boats, trying to get boats donated to the nonprofit, that's a real struggle. In 5 years, we've had one boat donated, and that boat ended up being a nightmare. This lady donated the boat, and she had dementia, and really nice lady, and she was living alone in this house in Annapolis. It was just a little Allberg 30. And the boat really wasn't worth much. And she was the original owner. She owned it for like 40 years, her and her husband. Husband passed away. But the problem was she had dementia. So one day she would donate it. Then the next day she would like forget. At one point she called the cops because she thought we were trying to steal her boat when we were trying to move her boat that she had donated. And of course we had all the paperwork. She signed it. But it was really crazy because you just didn't know. Like, I had to go over there a few times and it was always something different. And until the police got involved, and it was like, whoa. But then she would remember again and be like, oh yeah, I donated the boat. I'm sorry. Dementia is a sad situation. But I can't tell you how many times we've had like big boats that someone is going to donate, and for whatever reason, it didn't happen. At one point, it was like a 60-some foot aluminum hulled badass, would have been a flagship. But there was some things happening, it just didn't happen. That was set up on preconceived situations that fell through. Other times somebody wants to, I'll donate a boat so we can sell it. And the way that works, if you donate a boat to a nonprofit, if they sell it, you can only deduct what they sell it for. You can only deduct the full appraisal price if they use it in their program, and they got to use it in their program for 3 years. But that really is somewhat irrelevant, to be honest, because people don't donate boats to nonprofit organizations for financial reasons, you're going to get a good tax deduction, but that tax deduction is not going to equal what you would have got if you just sold that boat. You'll always make more money if you just sell the boat than if you donate the boat. But the reason you're donating the boat is because you want to see that organization succeed, and you want to help that organization succeed. So you donate your boat to it. Boats are worth a lot of money. You can run a nonprofit. Well, it doesn't take much to keep mine running, but it still takes more money than I'd like it to. But, you know, you can run a nonprofit for an entire year off of a good boat donation. Or, in this case, use it as a flagship for doing research. But anyways, it's just, I don't know, nonprofit's really frustrating situation, to be honest. Running one is really frustrating. It's about 85-90% failure and like 10% success. I mean, we succeed on our research expeditions. We collect the data that we set out to collect. You know, I mean, we've had a good successful track record when it comes to the mission and getting out there and collecting scientific data, whether it be on plastic trash in the ocean or climate issues in the Arctic or whatever it is. But, you know, in between, when you're back on land and it's like grant after grant and boat donation after boat donation, and things just fall through so often, it's kind of like being a Cleveland Browns fan. You know, when you're a fan of the Cleveland Browns, like, you don't get any expectations up. You know, they always got great draft picks because they're a horrible team, but you don't get excited about that. Because how many times in your past have you let yourself get excited and the Browns just lose and lose and lose? So it's sort of like that. I guess being a Browns fan, I should have much thicker skin for being in this nonprofit scenario, because it's like that. Like, you know, you got to learn not to get your hopes up, because things fall through so often and so many times. You think this connection with this organization or this person you just had lunch with who has all this access, who just totally said they're going to help you completely, and then they never do. That happens actually quite a bit. People say things and they don't do it. And you know, over the top things like, oh yeah, I'm going to donate. Or, oh yeah, I know people that cut $1 million checks every day and they'll be calling you soon. And you know, you never hear from the person ever again. It's just people blowing smoke, you know. But blowing smoke, unfortunately, has a lot to do with how organizations are getting funding. You know, like Oceana, for instance. A big organization in Washington, D.C., based out of Washington, D.C. Oceana does a lot of good stuff. Like, I'm not trying to give them a hard time as an organization, but I am trying to give them a hard time for the way that they pander to get their funding. You know, they'll send, like, a picture of, like, a, you know, like, an emaciated-looking baby seal with puppy dog eyes and try to get you to donate, like, looking at this sad seal with, like, a little thing above it, like, don't you want to help me? Or something like that, you know? And it's like they're using the suffering of this animal to get donations. And ultimately, they're using the suffering of this animal to turn a profit. You know, it's like, you remember the televangelists? They used to go to Africa, and they'd be sitting next to some little kid with a big belly, and they're talking about donate, donate, donate. And they're really using that child and that child's suffering as a tool to bring in more funding to their organization. You know, I mean, it's really no different in a roundabout sort of manner. And I hate it. I hate that kind of, because what they're doing is they're trying to use your emotions. They're trying to get you to donate to their organization by plucking at your heartstrings and by using your emotions to open your wallet. And I don't know, I hate the idea of that. And to send, you know, the reality is, let's say you click on this link you got, you know, this like Facebook thing you got, saying, oh, you know, baby seal with big puppy dog eyes. And you want to save this seal. You see this seal. You see this seal looks sad. It looks injured. You want to help that seal. You're pulling on your heartstrings. So you click on the box. You make a donation. That money you just donated is not going to go to save that seal. They're just using an arbitrary picture. It could be a picture of anything. It could be a whale. It could be a shark with no fins. It could be a sea turtle with plastic wrapped around its face. You know, they're just using an image to get you to give them money of some sad animal. And none of that money is going to go to that animal. It's just an image. That's all it is. And so what do? I run a nonprofit. I do ocean research. Should I go that path? Should I start going the path of like sending people pictures of emaciated baby seals, like, oh, doesn't this make you feel like crap? Yeah, okay, well then give me your money. You know, I don't want to take that route, you know? I remember I was walking down the street about seven, 8 years ago. I was walking down the street in Annapolis, Maryland. I don't remember what it was, 5, 6 years ago. Walking down the street in downtown, right? Minding my business. And I walked past this dude, and sometimes they got people who are like, I don't know, out there pandering, and this guy was doing it for Greenpeace. And I walked past this dude, and he's like, hey, you want to save a whale? And I turned to him, and I was like, I hate whales. You know, and I stepped right up in his face like I was about to beat his ass. And I felt like it, because it's like, how are you gonna say to me, hey, you want to save a whale? Like, so what does that mean? Like, if I don't give you money, then I don't want to save a whale? Like, what kind of mind trick are you trying to play with me? I don't know, I just, you know, and he was like, he took a step back. Like, you know, I, of course, I would like to save a whale. I care about whales just as much as anybody else cares about whales, you know? I thought it was, well, it was pretty funny at the time, really, because I told him, I hate whales. And like I was about to punch him. And he took, like, three steps backwards and, like, damn near dropped his clipboard, you know? And I just walked away. I didn't say anything else to the guy. But it's just, you know, I just hate that tactic. Like, I know what you're trying to do by asking me questions like that. And I know what you're trying to do by sending me pictures of emaciated baby seals. And I also know that your overhead is huge. You know, these guys got giant offices with tons of employees. The vast majority, if you donate $100 to one of these big nonprofits, the vast majority of that money is going to go to overhead. They can't help it. It's not like they're being evil. They're not sitting around, you know, the Greenpeaces and Oceanas of the world. They're not sitting around twiddling their thumbs, figuring out how we can get more money out of people so we can buy bigger houses and condos. It's not like that. It's the structure of the organizations themselves are just like large beasts, like a large animal that just has to eat a lot. You know, it's a big-ass animal. It needs a lot of food, and that food is money. And it's just the nature of how big organizations are. There's really no way around it when you get to that sort of a size. You know, I knew a guy that worked on Rainbow Warrior, you know, that boat that Greenpeace has. It's like this giant Greenpeace boat, Rainbow Warrior. He was one of the low-ranking guys on it. And he said something to me one day a few years back. He's like, hey, man, yeah, Rainbow Warrior just got like a $10 million refit or something like that. And I was like, wow, $10 million. I was like, man, you guys must have a really good laboratory on that boat. And he's like, no, what do you mean? We don't got a laboratory. I'm like, well, what do you mean you don't got a laboratory? You guys don't, like, do science and research? You're not collecting data? He's like, well, you know, once in a while we use this boat to, like, launch a rib and go see if, like, fishing boats are catching, like, fish they're not supposed to catch. And I was like, okay, well, that sounds like, how often do you do that? And he's like, well, not really that often. And I'm like, oh, what do you mean? So this boat, it's like millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's like a floating billboard? You tell me this thing just sails from one port to the next as like a giant billboard for how awesome they are? Like, look at me. I got the biggest boat. Like, I'm the best or something. Like, is that... And, you know, I'm being jaded right now. Look, I know I'm jaded. I know I'm being jaded. I'll totally point that out right now. But there is a mistake in that logic, that he who has the biggest boat is somehow doing the best research or having the biggest impact. You know, like I saw this this thing, people were sending me about this billionaire in Russia who wants to build a $500 million research boat to go collect plastic trash in the ocean. It's a crazy idea for so many levels, I don't even know where to start. First off, a 500-foot boat isn't going to be able to collect that much, or a $500 million boat, I'm sorry, it was like a 2,000-foot boat. This $500 million boat is not going to be able to collect a bunch of plastic trash. The ocean is vast and huge. Even a boat of that size is going to be tiny, like a pinprick, compared to what the size of the ocean is and what it would take. It was once estimated it would take 64 boats the size of a freighter, 10 years, working 24 hours a day just to clean up the Pacific garbage patch. So it's crazy right there. It's also crazy because the technologies have gotten smaller and less power hungry. We no longer need the big giant research vessels for a lot of different types of research. A 65-foot Bruce Roberts design steel-hulled boat is all you need. That's it. You can do 90% of the research that's being done today from that platform. Maybe 80%. All right, I'll even take it down a notch. Let's say 80%. That's still huge. Even if it was 50%, it would still be huge. You know, I mean, so these boats are much cheaper to operate. And so this is my thing about this guy. Like, if this guy's going to spend $500 million on one big giant research vessel, it sounds really cool. And like Rainbow Warrior, he's going to show up in all these ports with this big giant boat. And it's going to be like, look at me. Look at my big giant research vessel. Look how cool that is. The reality is, for $500 million, he could have like 160-foot sailboats out there doing 100 different types of research simultaneously all over the world. And yeah, none of them would be 2,000 feet long or whatever. They would be 65 feet long. But they'd be doing a lot more. So why doesn't Greenpeace just scrap Rainbow Warrior, sell that boat, and buy a bunch of sailboats? They could be doing tons of research. But that's not the point. That's not the point. The point is to be a giant billboard. So when you make donations to these big organizations, I mean, they've got huge overhead, massive overhead. So, of course, $90 of every $100 goes to overhead. You know, they got a lot of electric bills to pay, you know? So anyways, I got to cut the commercials.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
Hi, this is Bob Bitchin from Cruising Outpost Magazine. Hear all about my amazing life here on Boat Radio.
Hello and welcome back to Ocean Research Project. I am Matt Rutherford in Annapolis, Maryland, floating, sitting on my boat. You know, it's funny, I've been living on sailboats for like 11 years now, and I lived on 5 different sailboats, and I spend more of my time on the water than I do on land. I mean, I live on the boat, so I'm on the water whenever I'm home, and when I sleep at night, I'm on the water, and then I do all these sailing trips all over the place, and deliveries, and research expeditions, and so I'm like on, you know, obviously on the ocean at that time. So I think I'm on a boat or on the water for like, I don't know, 65-70% of the last, of all my time in the last 11 years. But so I was in Morocco last time. This was a trip I did when I sailed alone from Annapolis, Maryland to Europe, Africa, the Caribbean and back in 2008-2009. We're now in 2009, heading down the coast. I kept the boat in Amsterdam, went to Spain, Portugal, and I went to this port. I think it was called like Ashia. It's about 40 miles from Tangier. It's just south of Tangier on the Atlantic coast there. And so I left there with a couple of holes in my dinghy, and, sailed over to the next place. Was a river that went to Kenitra, and I told you guys briefly about the dangerous mouth and how a boat got flipped there, a Holberg Rossi 50 or something like that got flipped there, and everybody died but one like teenage girl. This was a year before I went there, which again, I can't say too many times, don't go running into port in the middle of a storm because you've got a good chance of getting killed trying to get into the inlet. You're better off staying out in the ocean. The further from land, the better. The further from currents, the better, the safer. But, so I go into this place. I went in there, you know, it sounds all big and bad. I went in there with like 1-inch swells, you know, like it was nothing basic. Well, I think there was a little bit baby swell, but it was, you know, there was no wind at all. I motored into it, and I motored about 8 miles up this river. Actually, I stopped and dropped an anchor at first, and, there was like this fish market I was off of and all these other fishing boats. I didn't know where the hell to go at to be honest with you. And it was a bad place. It wasn't a place to go to land. It wasn't a place to leave the boat. It was rowdy. It was like a lot of rowdy Moroccan fishermen, basically. And I dropped an anchor and like drank some wine. I had some Spanish wine still on the boat. And I just said, you know, in the morning, I'll figure something out. So spent the night there, moved over, and about 8 miles up the river was Kenitra. Kenitra was a U.S. Air Force base at one point. I believe it was the Air Force. I mean, it might have been the Army. I don't remember which. But the U.S. were there for some time. I think they left in, like, the 80s or something like that. I don't remember exactly. But they had this big, giant port there. And, like, a port big enough for freighters with these big cranes and these really big warehouses. And the whole thing took up a large space. They built all this infrastructure and, like, nothing ever happened. Like, it fell apart or something. There was, like, a freighter there, like a smallish size freighter, you know, maybe like 400 feet, 500 feet, something like that, when I was there. But they had nowhere near the amount of traffic. But anyways, I passed this giant, like, I didn't know where I was going. And there's a bridge. I could see a bridge that I cannot get under, like a really short bridge, like a bridge you'd have a hard time getting under in a freaking Boston Whaler, let alone a sailboat. And so I saw this barge tied off to this barge, so I tied off to the barge that was tied off to the barge that was tied off to this port. And it was actually a really good situation because it was free. Nobody charged me anything. I was there for a while, like a few weeks. And the barge I was tied off to didn't have anything on it. But the barge that barge was tied off to had like a lot of big machinery. Well, not a lot, but like a few pieces of big machinery on it. And like other scraps and crap. And there was always a security guard, like, on patrol there. It was one of two different people. They worked like 12-hour shifts. And there was a bunch of dogs. And the dogs were always barking, and they were like vicious, like desert Moroccan dogs that were like pissed off, you know. And they had rope around them, but it was only so long. And so, like, you had to walk the perimeter because the dog would charge at you and like barking, and then it would like get to the end of its rope and it would get like twisted back, and then it would just sit there like pulling on its rope as hard as it can, just barking. And there was a bunch of dogs. You know, it wasn't like one, it was like five dogs on freaking ropes that are like 25-foot long ropes. So anyways, so there was this guy I befriended who was a security. They had security there even though it wasn't really, I don't know how necessary it was. There wasn't hardly anything. It was weirdest thing. It was like a ghost port, you know, like a ghost town, but it was a ghost port. Because there was really, like, there were like a dozen security people, but they just laid around and slept. Like, not, like tumbleweeds were blowing through the place, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was just not much going on. It was a financial disaster, probably, for whoever invested in it. But, anyways, the security guy, like, he's the first guy I meet. And I'm there during Ramadan also, and I'm not Muslim, but I figure, you know, what the hell, I'll do Ramadan while I'm here, when in Rome, sort of thing, which basically means you can't drink water or eat food anytime that the sun is up. So if you want to eat or drink water, you do so, and like you get up before the sun rises and do it, and then there's a big feast after the sun sets in the evening. And it's like a big family event, you know, like everybody's there. Like, so I got invited to all these different, well, to several different, like, people's houses. And so, I mean, my Ramadan was pretty easy. And you can't drink alcohol during that time. I still drank alcohol at night. I wasn't not doing Ramadan completely. But the important part of the Ramadan part I was doing was a no food and water during the daytime thing. And I also went to a bunch of, I went to some mosques, you know, those five times a day that they pray. I'll go to a couple different mosques, usually with this security guy, or with the other guy. So, anyway, so first off, this security guy who's there, he's a big dude. He's like, I don't know, 260 pounds, probably 270 pounds, probably like 6'5", big Moroccan dude named Saeed. And, cool dude, spoke some English, sort of broken, and I, you know, whatever, but we could hang out and sort of communicate. And he was like the former Sambo champion of Morocco. Sambo is like this wrestling, it's like wrestling meets jiu-jitsu, sort of. It's popular in Russia, but it's a martial art. And so he's like, hey, you want to go to the Sambo training with me? And I'm like, all right, sure, let's go. You know, sounds good to me. I've like toiled in various martial arts in my life. I've never mastered any of them, but I did learn bits and bobbles from different ones. But so anyways, we go there, I meet the instructor guy, we do like, you know, I they try to teach me some moves, and they teach me like this takedown, and I'm practicing with this other guy who's much smaller, and my dude's like, my friend Saeed is like chucking people left and right. And so they say, hey, you want to come back, you know, later, this next time, you know, like a week from now. I was in Morocco for a few weeks in Kenitra because I had changed my technique. I wanted to, as I said at the end of last one, I wanted to park my boat somewhere for a few weeks and use the trains. And Morocco has really good trains. So so that's what I would suggest. Well, that's the way I did it. And you can go to, like, Casablanca one day, and you can go to, like, you know, Rabat the next day. You can go to Marrakesh, whatever you want. Just take trains and... But anyway, so I was hanging out with this dude when I wasn't taking trains. And so they told me to come back, so I come back, right? And it was different, though. There was, like, benches this time, and with a lot of people, maybe, like, 50, 60 people sitting in, like, bleachers. You know, they're, like, bleachers, like old aluminum bleachers that weren't there before. And they said that I was going to wrestle Saeed in, like, an exposition match, you know? And I'm like, all right, well, whatever, I'll wrestle the guy, but, you know, he's, like, the Sambo champion, and he's, like, 6'5 and 260 pounds, and he's a big dude. Like, his arms were bigger than my legs, you know, it was that sort of thing. But he's my friend, so I was like, all right, sure, whatever. And so I don't speak the language, obviously, and they're saying some stuff before the match. There was a few matches before ours where, like, people were, you know, wrestling or doing Sambo, whatever, taking each other out. But it wasn't, like, you know, whatever. It was rough. You know, people weren't, like, bleeding, like, all over the place. They weren't trying to kill each other, but they were definitely, like, going at it. So anyways, they say some stuff, and now it's me and Saeed, and everyone's, like, cheering. And I don't understand what they're saying, so I go in and start wrestling with... And he, like, lets me put a couple of moves on him, and, I, you know, take him to the ground. I took him to the ground once. But what I didn't know, and I learned later... is that that guy had said that the former Sambo champion Saeed versus the former U.S. Sambo champion me. So he was basically, it was like supposed to be the U.S. champion, the former U.S. champion versus the former Moroccan champion. So it became this whole like U.S. versus Morocco thing to see like which country was stronger, you know, like he was like, I didn't get it till later because I was wondering like why all the hype, you know, people are going nuts. But anyways, he let me take him down once, and then he tossed me around like a rag doll. You know, he was picking me up and throwing me around, and the crowd was going wild as I was getting freaking tossed all over the damn place. But it was actually a fun time. I had a good time with it. And you wind up sometimes in these weird, wacky situations on different trips. And I think it helps to be alone. I think these sort of scenarios only really happen to somebody when they travel alone. The traveling alone is, and I've done a lot of it, it's a double-edged sword. Most of the time you're not going to have anybody, you're not going to find these situations, most of the time it can be pretty damn lonely, or you're on the move, and if you're on the move, like sailing or biking or hiking or whatever you're doing, then you're busy doing something, so you're busy. You know, it's really more when you stop in towns and places does it get lonelier, but you wind up in these crazy situations too, because had you had somebody with you, I would never would end up hanging out with security guard, who has to be being a Sambo champion, who, I ended up fighting Morocco versus America, and I'm sorry, my fellow Americans, to let you down. I got my ass kicked, basically, by in that match. But yeah, so I left Kenitra after a few weeks, and before I left, I also made friends with the other guy. There was the other security guy who just was security where all the dogs were on the for the other barge with the machine equipment, and that guy had a real extended family, like. We would go to his Ramadan meal at night, and there was just like 50, 60 people. And the way they ate was like a big giant plate, like one big plate just full of food, like a massive pile of food. But it is like somewhat, you know, it makes sense, you know, maybe something is here and something is there, you know, it's not all mashed together. It's still somewhat in different groups. And everybody just eats with their hands, you know, and for the most part, which I'm not very good at, and grandma would always be the last one to be able to leave. In this particular household, I had several meals with these guys. Grandma would, like, make me eat, like, till I was going to explode, you know? Like, every time I tried to get up, she'd be like, nope, down. Like, we didn't speak the same language, obviously, but I could tell, you know, what was going on. I wasn't going to disobey grandma, so I ate a lot. And I left out of Kenitra, and I was going to stop again in a port in Morocco, but I decided just to continue on to the Canary Islands. And so I just sailed out of this river where Kenitra is, and just sailed. I sailed along the coast for a while. Saw a weird net one night. I didn't make much sense. You know, I think that night or the next night near the Moroccan coast, it had lights on it. It looked like a long net with lights on it. It looked like a freaking hazard to me. Wouldn't want to sail into it. And I also caught a mahi-mahi that was hiding underneath of a dead sheep, which was kind of interesting. But if you find something floating in the water, mahi like to hang out underneath things that are floating. So in this case, it was a dead sheep, but I got a fish. And went to the Canary Islands, and I'll continue on from there later. But check out Ocean Research Project, www.oceanresearchproject.org. Dave, check out the David Walters website. You know, if you end up listing your boat with me, it's not just me, it's the entire team, you know, working to help sell that boat. And we got some of the best in the country, so we got some great listings. So, yeah. I hope you guys do well, and until next time.
Bonnie Last Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonnie Last is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonnie Last Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnielastcharters.com.
Hi, I'm Sarah O'Kelly from Skipper's Review, and you're listening to Boat Radio.
Kau yang nak kau rauk. Kau yang nak ikhlas. Kau yang nak syuk.